As a child, Vivek Narayanan sensed the enormity of the world in the tall grass of his backyard. Before he could read, he discovered that words made shapes and patterns with their sounds. Today, the cadences of languages he once knew orchestrate his dreams. Vivek Narayanan is a poet who constructs new topography for language, unconstrained by space and time. His words play, twist, and dance, honoring our erratic relationship with the many worlds we inhabit, and rejoicing in what will always be unknown. Vivek's own center is a shifting one. He was born in Jharkhand, India, learned to walk in Tanzania, came of age in Zambia, furthered his education in the United States, taught anthropology in South Africa, wrote books of poetry in Delhi and Chennai, and most recently relocated to Fairfax, Virginia. In his poems, far-flung places live side by side, and the lines that demarcate who we are pleasurably unreliable. I spoke with Vivek at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, and our conversation touched on childhood quirks, the importance of irrationality, and the writer's unearthly intuition. What do you remember about your first house?
The earliest house I remember was in Zambia, and I have a very intense memory of this house because we had at that age what seemed to me like a kind of enormous backyard with kind of filled with yellow grass. And at the end of the backyard was a tree and a swing hanging from it. And these proportions seemed much larger to me than I bet if I went back there now, it wouldn't seem like so large. So going out into that backyard by myself, you know, was something that was very important to me as a child.
Hmm. You have lived in India and Zambia, Tanzania, and you've also lived in South Africa.
In South Africa.
As well as the US. Yeah. Where is home?
You know, the sort of default answer for that often becomes where your parents live, which is Chennai. And Chennai is interesting for me also because it's one of the few places that I've actually kept going back to all through my life. So I remember being there, you know, as a 2-year-old, 3-year-old. And I remember going back, you know, every year. And I've continued to do that. And I've lived there for stretches of time in the 2000s. So Chennai has a kind of solidity as a home only because I've seen it change over time. Mm-hmm. Whereas many of the other places where I lived are kind of fixed in the time in which I left them. So that would be one way to answer the question. Another way to answer it would be that it seems that we really, in a kind of intense way, we seem to live in many places at the same time. And I think that though I hadn't planned it this way, this was in a way a kind of a theme of my first book of poems, because what someone observed and what I realized was the case is that several of the poems are actually set in many places at the same time. So the whole idea of place is something that seems to be, in the plural, and kind of in the idea of like this kind of simultaneous existence of different places.
The idea of a native place is often so important among Indians, especially sort of where are you from, and what they really mean by that is what village, what caste, what mother tongue, all of these things, right? But I wonder, is there a way of thinking about origin in a way that's not so sort of restrained, that acknowledges dislocation, that feels sort of more, I don't know, maybe 21st century?
Well, I mean, one thing that happens to me is that, it's kind of awkward actually. But whenever anyone asks me where are you from, it always turns into a narrative, inevitably. Mm. Because I can't completely perform a kind of authentic identity in any one place. I can perform the idea of being an Indian best, and that's the way that people kind of understand me most easily. So I've also kind of slipped into being able to perform that because I realize that it makes me legible in a certain way. So I think that you know, at least what initially what seems to happen is that you shift from the idea of a kind of a static place that you're from or that you are to the idea of a narrative, a kind of a narrative that is kind of unfolding. And many different questions of identity could be approached in that way. I think if someone asks you, what gender are you, it could be approached more meaningfully as a narrative than as an answer. Or if someone asked you what your sexual preference is or sexual orientation, that again could be approached more meaningfully as a narrative. But it will have to mean that you don't have kind of allegiances across groups of people. And so that is the other kind of story behind this, which is the sort of pull of the nation state, that ultimately that plays a big role in us having to kind of state our allegiances and where we're from. And so somewhere, at least in most conversations, where you're from is the kind of story of what nation state do you hold allegiance to. And as that breaks down, then you're going to kind of enter people having to negotiate complexity of who they are in different ways. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And then there's also this, I think, desire when you are constantly dislocating yourself to transplant yourself in your new place quite quickly. Do you have any rituals or habits? Anything that you do every day?
Well, that would be the writing, I guess, and the writing desk. If I have a particular desk that I write on, I need to kind of charge that space and that desk in particular ways. So that takes time.
Baptizing the new desk.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I remember little things from my childhood, like I would make lists of everything in my head and put it down on paper very quickly. And I would also go on sort of long walks in the woods and rename everything I saw in nature. And thinking about it now, I could sort of look back and say those were sort of writing exercises. I wonder, what are your early memories with words?
There was a whole thing about kind of collecting twigs, which became very important to me. I kind of collected a whole, I'm not sure why now, but I collected a whole bunch of twigs this is when I was about 4 or 5. That I kept under my bed. And then that became my, this kind of trio of words, which I guess I had, which was Aichigam, Mulugam, Billy Blue Gum. So Aichigam was ice cream. Mulukambu is thorn twig in Tamil. And Billy Blue Gum was my teddy bear. So I also had, you know, I think my first words that I spoke were apparently in Swahili, you know, but I've completely forgotten Swahili. So since a young age, I've had a kind of vocabulary in languages that I don't really understand or can't speak. Mm-hmm. I often have dreams where people are speaking languages that I don't understand. So I kind of have a sort of sound memory of various languages in my kind of coexisting in my head. It's almost like I have a better feel for the sound of languages than the actual nuts and bolts of using them.
Mm. That reminds me again of children and the way kids read and sound out words and fumble and make mistakes. And that's, in some sense, a mistake, but it's also experimentation. How do you experiment?
Well, Well, it's a good question, actually, because it's not something I think about too much. And it's been pointed out to me that I have different accents that I seem to move in and out of. But for some reason, the most common recurring accent that I have is one I got from my parents, which is the South Indian sort of accent. And people say that that I'm very persistent in my the way that I stick to some of the ways, South Indian ways of saying words, and that comes out, that's reflected in my prosody and in my poems and how I work and so on and so forth. And that's part maybe what's that makes them confusing for other people too, because they can't hear that South Indian accent. So there's that. But one of the ways in which I like to experiment sometimes is when I've written a poem, I'll usually run it through one of the automatic voice things. Like maybe Microsoft Sam or something like that, you know, and so then I can hear it more clearly as just something that is sounded in that kind of computer Microsoft Sam voice. So that kind of makes me aware of how it's possible to run it in different ways. And now I think they have one with an Indian accent. I haven't seen that yet, but really? Yeah. So they're now trying to diversify all of those things. It's an interesting. At first I thought, okay, this is the kind of objective way to hear my poems, but then I realized it wasn't really that.
Do you think that there is a way of approaching reading somebody else's work that is sort of more wise?
It's from primarily tone. For some reason, I have now playing in my head. This kind of line, kind of rap lyric by Guru, this rapper from the 90s, and he says, "A lot of cats got flavor, some got skills, but if you ask me, it's mostly the voice." You know, so I would say it's mostly the voice or the tone that one has to kind of lock into in one way or another, and it requires a kind of a generosity from the reader to be able to make this adjustment to be able to kind of tune into this voice in the first instance. One of the ways, as I said, is that I like to do is to pick up a bunch of recordings of the poet and then read along on the page. So I have that kind of simultaneity of listening to it and also reading it, and I can start to begin to understand the relationship and the poet's kind of method of notation. If you think of poetry as a kind of notation or transcription, and so you figure those things out. So the funny thing is that, say, I mentioned John Ashbery, which was somebody I sometimes considered a difficult poet, whom I learned to read in this way, not through any critical armature or anything. But the strange thing is that I did that for a while, and then I had also maybe gone to a couple of readings, and at some point I kind of had his voice, or a kind of imitation of his voice, in my head. And by the way, this is a common party trick for poets, is to kind of imitate John Ashbery. A lot of people do this. So, but once I had this voice in my head, I found I could no longer listen to any recordings of his. That kind of interfered with the John Ashbery I had kind of produced in my head. So now I don't listen to his recordings. Now I just read the book, and I can't listen to his recordings. So this is a kind of a strange, strange sort of zone in which poetry exists and moves back and forth, which is the spoken voice, the written voice, and then also the voice that the reader produces in her head as she reads. So that's a kind of a third zone in which kind of this ghost voice that gets produced in your head as you read something.
I found there's a really lovely sense of uncertainty in some of your work. Not sort of a hesitancy with language or anything, but a sense that the world is sort of being remade and is uncertain, and there's a loss in that, but there's also a kind of humor and lightness and absurdity about it. What is certain for you, and what is uncertain?
I've always felt a kind of a great deal of kind of doubt and uncertainty as a writer, on many, many different levels. And it would seem that you know, many writers kind of confess to this from time to time, that even sort of great writers confess to it from time to time. But somehow, that isn't always what comes out when people write. They tend to kind of project a sort of sense of authority or sense of certainty that, you know, apparently they don't have. So that's something that I'm kind of trying to really not do, either in my creative writing or in my critical writing, is to find a way to kind of be vulnerable and kind of like find a sort of voice or a tone or a frame by which one can communicate the fact that one doesn't know, you know, and that the process of writing is very far from arriving at any kind of certainty, and that it's a process of kind of continual revision and experiment and so on and so forth, and so that things are not settled, things are not clear. Even the way my own work looks to me, it seems to kind of be kind of always changing its faces to me. It seems to be reading different to me all the time. So even when I've kind of produced a sort of a fixed text, when I look at it, it keeps looking like different things to me. And each time I perform it also, it looks like a different object to me. I never know what face is going to present to me or whether I'm going to like it or not. It seems to be hard to settle. And it's a mistake to hide that. That if you hide that, you're doing a disservice to the process itself.
Mm. Right. Yeah. Because I think also something that one often strives to do is convey the process in the final work, and perhaps one way of doing that is sort of being more honest about your own tentativeness, one's own sort of changeability and inconsistency even.
Inconsistency, you're right. That might have to do with also kind of somewhere with my life and having moved around different places and switching codes. So certain texts that seem very legible and clear in certain contexts seem kind of illegible in other contexts. And as someone who kind of moves around, one has to kind of take that on board, because you don't settle into any one idea of even the audience or of legibility or of clarity or of, you know, all those things.
Mm. I think maybe also uncertainty is sort of integral to curiosity, in that you're never quite sure, so you always have this pursuit, this need to learn, to understand, to remake, that I think can be so vital. Are you familiar with this South African artist William Kentridge?
Yeah.
He has this idea about sort of cultivating irrational thinking and a sense of stupidity or unnecessary stupidity. Does that resonate with you at all?
Yeah, it does. I think that what it means is that on some level, the writer is reaching just beyond the limits of what she knows, and she has to kind of, you know, do that, but also perhaps she has to reach just beyond it, you know, so that makes a kind of a powerful combination. You know, this Stevens's idea of the poem as something that almost eludes the intelligence. So and the question of irrationality is a very important one for various reasons. The kind of realm of art is the sort of last realm of at least polite or regular society where that is permissible. Mm-hmm. So if there's any kind of definition of an artist in terms of how society thinks of an artist today, it would be the idea that it's okay for them to be a little bit insane or a little bit irrational, or, you know, that's allowed. You're left to not make sense. You're allowed to not make sense either to yourself or to others. I don't feel like when I'm writing poetry, I sometimes, you know, like after I've finished, I sometimes feel like maybe, like in some strange way, like I wasn't there when it was happening. Like I wasn't present for it in a particular way. And so sometimes what I've written looks to me a little bit kind of strange. And then the other side of me kicks in and I'm kind of reading it and so on. And so sometimes I it takes me a while to figure out what I've said. And it's I don't know, it's an experience I have. It's a strange experience, because it's like suddenly 1 year later it's like, oh, that's what I must have meant. Mm. And then it seems very clear.
Yeah, I suppose you could also sort of think of it as accidental, not in a perfunctory way, but accidental in that you might not be conscious in a way that you understand.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This idea of form itself having a kind of intelligence in it. I mean, the idea of meaning is very kind of overrated in my mind. I'm not always interested in what a text is means. I'm interested in what it's doing. And you might have a similar experience when you're kind of cutting together a radio piece of, you know, where do you put that cut? And how do you arrange the pieces, and what do you? That's probably not a very logical, rational process, is it? It's an intuitive process. So that means that you're kind of feeling for the sense of form that's kind of acting on it, and kind of trusting that, and that's a kind of ancient practice. You know, you could trace it back to kind of rituals and ritualistic speech and things like this, where this whole idea of the form becomes so much more highlighted than the meanings of the things or the words and so on. And maybe that is also what Kentridge is talking about, that he has certain faith in that this sort of intuitive sense of form is going to pay off somewhere. Right. It's going to have something to say.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know you're involved with the Sarai program at the Center for the Study of Developing Societies, CSDS. Yes, yes. Okay. And you also have a background in anthropology. Can you talk a bit about these worlds and that work?
I think a place like Sarai has been very important to me, because it kind of legitimates this dialogue that the sort of work that that artists, performers, writers do is as important as the work that social scientists do, and that there can be a kind of productive engagement between these kind of fields towards an imagining of something new, which may not be carved up in the way that it is now. When I first joined Sarai, it was working with something called the Independent Fellowship Program. That means that anybody who wanted to do research coming from any practice or any background could submit it. They didn't have to belong to any formal institution. And that really turned up a whole bunch of people, and they keep turning up. People who, you know, maybe they work at a bank, or they run a family company, or, you know, whatever. They're just doing this or that. But they also have a side project which involves like translating a 600-page tome, or involves, you know, various kinds of things that they're interested in and kind of intellectually alive. And so curiously, because the whole idea of education in India narrowed so much that only engineering and medicine or whatever were considered, and accountancy were considered the legitimate fields, a lot of people got kind of pushed into those kinds of things or other kinds of professions of one kind or another. And so what happened was that their kind of intellectual lives continued, but in this kind of like almost very autodidactic, kind of untutored, sort of wild way.
I know it's impossible to talk about Indian writing or Indian poetry, as though it's sort of a singular thing. But I wonder, do you see any trends in terms of the inclination or interest of poets specifically writing in English, patterns, or what sorts of politics are writers, are poets interested in?
I'm not sure if this is true or not, but one thing that we've been talking about, say with older poets and so on, is that our relationship to language seems to be different. I mean, I've heard an older poet tell me and other people who, you know, kind of my generation, they say when I read your work, I feel like language is telling me, you know, look, I can do a hell of a lot. I think what it is that it seemed like for an earlier generation of Indian English poets, language was something more transparent, as something that could have a more transparent relationship with the truth. So an utterance had a certain kind of value and weight to it. So the poetry was kind of written and carved from that sort of approach to the importance of language or the importance of so on. And I think that for me and probably other people in my generation, there's more a sense of, you know, language already being some kind of broken and imperfect instrument. Mm. That it's kind of meaningless and even dishonest for me to kind of try to produce these sort of simple utterances that are going to have this kind of oracular weight to them, that I'm always going to start out trying to say one thing and end up saying something else, or that it's going to be a kind of a struggle with language to actually get at this idea of reality, and somewhere that I'm going to lose. Not that I shouldn't try, but in a strange way that also opens it up, which means that you can be more playful with language. Certainly I feel kind of okay with being more messy with language, because I don't have this notion that I can then eventually arrive at something that is like a, you know, like a completely weighty utterance, that it's always going to be undermined. Mm-hmm. So my strategy is more kind of like working with this thing which is already sort of incommensurable with what I want to say. Mm-hmm. The fact that I'm working in the English language, which anyway is not going to be able to do everything I want to do with it, because there are other languages sitting side by side. And so I feel also more permission to be more playful. Mm-hmm. And the younger poets who are living in the internet age and in a kind of glut of language, but also just this complete glut of languages, mm-hmm, being bombarded with it, you know, and so we're thinking about it differently.
Mm-hmm.
So, but
are you particularly attached to the book, the physical book?
Well, I'm attached to the idea of coexistence. I read online, I read on my e-reader, and I read physical books, and I think that there's a real kind of beauty and weight to the physical book that I like. I'm definitely against, I don't believe that the book, I don't believe in the end of the printed book or anything like that. I think that's nonsense. But I'm not a kind of against online books in that sense. I make use of them all the time. So
mm-hmm.
What happened was that when I left the US, I basically stopped publishing in print journals here, because it didn't make any sense for me to find my poems kind of come out far away and meet an audience of 800 or 1,000 people there. And so I kind of really switched almost exclusively to publishing in online journals.
Mm.
And there was a sense of kind of simultaneity to be able to feel like I could publish something and have it be read all over the world at the same time.
Yeah.
That I really liked. And when they published an American edition of my first book in 2011, one thing I did ask, because there was already an earlier edition around, one thing I asked them was that if they could make a free online copy available, you know, after some time after publication, So my first book, exists as a printed copy that you can pay for, and as an online copy that is kind of circulating and dispersing, and I'm sure kind of breaking up and so on and so forth. Because I really feel that that's something to how fundamental to how language works. There's something wrong with the idea of copywriting a poem. Mm. Yeah.
I'd like to return briefly to this idea of multilingualism that's come up a few times. We've talked about this beauty of the Indian street and the fact that languages just kind of coexist and flow in and out of each other, and it's quite common to be bilingual, trilingual.
To different degrees,
right, to have a strong understanding of one language, a less strong understanding of another, but sort of have both be in and out of your life all the time and not sort of delineate so clearly. How can this idea of multilingualism translate itself into a physical book?
I think it's happening more in scripts other than the Roman script. For instance, I know a Tamil author who has like whole paragraphs of his book in English, but in the Tamil script. Well, there are two things, right? One is that you could tap into a pool of sort of common words that, a whole range of people, enough people know them, certain Hindi words, for instance, that everybody, even in Tamil Nadu, people will know these words. So if you deploy those words in a thing, then you can be understood very easily. The second thing is thinking about what it means to make a text where the reader is not going to understand every word. The example I can think of this is actually not an Indian novel. It's a novel by one of my favorite writers called Soza Boy. It's Ken Saro-Wiwa, Nigerian writer. So it's written in kind of somewhere between English and Nigerian pidgin, Lagos pidgin. And it has a long glossary at the back. So if you're someone who's not from that culture, you can enter this book. But it takes a bit more work because you have to get used to working with glossaries as you read. That's one thing, glossaries. Another kind of possibility that, now this is one something that I haven't seen really anybody work with, but is the idea of Google translation and machine translation. I have a hunch that there's going to be some very interesting things coming out of that, because that's becoming a very powerful way of kind of working through. So that if you don't understand something, there are different ways in which you can run it through these Google things and start to figure out what's going on there. Mm. So in other words, you'll have this multilingual text, but some point you're going to, depending on where you're positioned as the reader, you're going to have to negotiate these other tools in the middle, like the glossary and the dictionary and the Google Translate or whatever. There's a poem which I kind of like perversely call the greatest Indian post-colonial poem. But this is a very interesting, it's an incredible poem written in the 60s by Arun Kolatkar. And it's called Maine Manager Ko Bola. And this poem is written in what's sometimes called Bambaya, which means that it's Hindi, basically, but it's a kind of like bad Hindi. It's like, it has its own grammatical rules a little bit. And it has these porousness of English words in it. And there's a whole kind of interaction between the English and the Hindi in this poem. As it happens in this poem, all the English words kind of denote power in some sense. They're like manager, rules, police, those are the kind of, and you realize that for a lot of Indians, the English words that feature in their head are these like kind of like symbols of the state and so on and so forth. So now the thing about this poem is that it presents itself as a transcription of a bunch of things that a few people say, and there seem to be three narrators in the poem, and it's presented as someone talking. So what he what Kolhatkar is dealing with is kind of the transcription of the oral to the written. But that transcription is not a simple or an obvious process at all. In fact, the process of transcription is also a process of making and remaking and kind of shaping. I don't know if you ever transcribe your podcasts, if you ever do that.
Absolutely, yeah.
So that's have you found that's a fascinating process?
Absolutely.
You know, what do you keep, what do you not keep, how do you represent the spoken on the page?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that would be another way is to kind of think about this idea of transcription of the oral. And think of it not just as a kind of like supposedly robotic notation, but in fact something that requires a bit of reinvention and remaking. And I think that those kinds of practices will help us move closer towards kind of bringing together the oral multilingualism and the written monolingualism.
There is also a necessary letting go and an acceptance that you won't understand everything on the page,
right,
just as you don't understand everything when you're walking down the street.
Yeah, I think that it's going to require, you know, many ways a different kind of reading. So,
great, thank you so much.
Yes.
This piece was produced by Meera Sharma and Henry Peck for the Fuchsia Tree Arts Zine.